from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a live Zoom interview with Vermont author Joy Cohn, whose debut novel, 37, was published this fall by Guernica Editions. I don't know if I have to say it with that. Guernica Editions. It's fun to use my Spanish. She is the author of three published works of nonfiction and many theatrical scripts, video scripts, teleplays, and screenplays. Joy has had a varied career as an award-winning writer and educator. Her primary focus has been on the arts, wellness, the environment, and social justice. In addition to writing, Joy taught K through 12 art and K through 12 science in public schools and was an adjunct at UVM, developing and teaching graduate courses on the creative process, art-driven curriculum development, multicultural arts, and teaching for social justice and equity. Joy is a yoga instructor certified through Yoga Vermont, and she grows and prepares and loves to share plant-based foods that are healthy for the body and the planet and quite delicious too. Joy was born in Brooklyn, and she is in New York right now and speaking to us by Zoom in just a minute here. She returns to New York often. She lives in rural Vermont along the shores of Lake Champlain, where she loves the changing seasons and the natural beauty. So here's a little information about her debut novel, 37, which is a genre-blending novel that combines a contemporary self-discovery travelogue with historical fiction, literary fiction, and elements of magical realism. If small-town reporter Polly Stern has to cover one more manure runoff story, she's going to lose her mind. With her career at a standstill, her marriage over, her nest empty, her spiritual foundation precarious, and her family keeping a vital secret from her, Polly is desperate for answers and change. She sets out on an unintended journey, stumbling upon story after story that, for some reason, coincidence or fate, all occurred in the year 1937. Polly's path leads her to a troubled teen on a stone bridge high in the Green Mountains of Vermont, a tribal chief near a remote hut in uncharted Papua New Guinea, a volunteer soldier in a foggy olive grove in Spain, and many others. Blurring the lines between reality and fantasy, truth and fiction, present and past, Polly writes about these characters and others in nine linked stories and learns about herself in the process. So, without any further ado, I'm going to just welcome Joy Cohn to Write the Book. Joy, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Shayla. It's really a pleasure. This is going to be fun.
It will be really fun. Now, I'm seeing Joy. Nobody on the radio can see Joy, but she's sitting with her back to an incredible view of the skyline of, what are we looking at, actually?
Well, this is the Hudson River. We're actually looking at the skyline of New Jersey.
Of New Jersey, right.
But I'm right around the corner from the One World Trade Center. I just went up the Tower Observatory last night.
Oh, wow.
So I got the full 360 view of Manhattan. Amazing.
Amazing, yeah. And then, so you're there, but you live in Vermont. And you sort of split your time? Are you mostly in Vermont these days?
I'm mostly in Vermont, but I go back and forth. I'm spending a month here right now. I'm actually working on a play. And I just rewrote a short play that I had started in Middlebury at the Middlebury Theater Pop-Up Festival years ago. So I just rewrote that and submitted that. And I'm working on a full-length play while I'm here.
Oh, wonderful. Fantastic. I want to talk to you about 37. What an intriguing book. And, you know, it's funny, I often will avoid asking people how they came up with their ideas for a certain book because it's just kind of a question you hear a lot. But in this case, it really is a very unique book. And I can't imagine it was just one idea. It feels like it must have just sort of come together as you went. But let me ask you to answer that question. How did this come together for you?
That's a great question. Of course, it was an evolution. And as the creative process is, things do take on a life of their own. Mm-hmm. It started one of the short stories. So thank you for giving that great introduction. There are nine short stories embedded in the novel that all take place in 1937, when the rest of the novel is a contemporary thread. And my publisher was calling it Cloud Atlas meets Eat, Pray, Love. And I love that description. But it is that kind of a woman's self-discovery journey through a travelogue.
Right.
Mixed in with this time, kind of changing in time. So it started out, one of the short stories is kind of somewhat autobiographical. And I had gone to the Dominican Republic, and my husband at the time and I were thinking about going back and purchasing property there, maybe to have a place to retire to. And I am a Jewish woman, and I have a kind of a complicated relationship with my Judaism, which does show up in the novel. You know, it's a fantastic religion. It's an incredible culture. I was raised in New York. Very strict. I was kosher. We had 5 sets of dishes. So, you know, everything was kind of very traditional. Yet I was really more drawn to the cultural, the food, the music, the just, you know, the cultural aspects of it. And so there's kind of a mixture of that. But when we considered going to the Dominican Republic, I just wondered if there would be other Jews there. I don't even know why that kind of came up for me, but I just did what I normally do. I just, you know, decided to Google and do like Jews, Dominican Republic. And this story that happened in 1937 just blew me away. And I went there and I spent hours interviewing this man who was in his 90s, who had moved there and in 1937. And I don't know how much you want me to tell you about that particular story. I mean, I'd be happy to, but
well,
this.
No, that's great. You can. I do have questions about some of these things because
okay.
they do come
okay.
into your book. So let's just keep going. That's fine.
Well, I won't really tell you too much about that story. It was just the idea was after I interviewed him, I just thought it was such a beautiful and powerful story. I mean, essentially, it's about the time when. You know, 600,000 Eastern European Jews wanted to flee, knowing what was about to happen. And all the world leaders met, and no one, including Roosevelt, would take any of these people in, except for Trujillo, who was he was comparable to Hitler in terms of being a vicious dictator. But he wanted, so this was the ironic twist, is he wanted to bring Jewish men in to interbreed with the Dominican women and lighten the bloodlines. Because even though he was a black man, he disdained the darker skin. So it's just one of these things of talking about identity and how we can just, you know, have our own perspective of what identity is and how we can use identity against others. So when I wrote the short story, of course, as a writer, I had to do research to really fill in the details. What music was playing during that time period? How were people dressed? What were they buying? What were they thinking? And the more I started to find out about that particular year, I couldn't stop writing. So, you know, I found out about these amazing things, found a little germ about the very first Tibetan soccer team in 1937. I found a photo and I'm like, what? So I wanted to write about that. And then I found out about, you know, Amelia Earhart, she disappeared in Papua New Guinea in 1937. So, who was living in Papua New Guinea in 1937? There were a lot of what ifs. So I took the germs of actual events, for the most part, of what I found, and then fictionalized them.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Okay. Now, your primary narrator, Polly, is, as I said in the introduction, she's a reporter covering pretty unexciting stories and wanting change. Just generally speaking, when I am reading a book and I learn that a protagonist is perhaps going to be doing some investigatory work and is a reporter, that always gets me excited. I don't know. We see so many cops, and some of the cop books are really interesting. But I love reporters as investigators. You know, they have a little bit of a different slant, a little bit of a different interest. So I was excited to see that you had a newspaper reporter. So have you done that kind of writing in your life?
I have not.
No.
I have not. And I thank you for that, actually, perspective. I hadn't thought of it that way, but I really like that, what you just said.
Yeah.
I hadn't, but I will tell you that one of my kind of writing mentors, and he has unfortunately passed away, was John Hilperty. He's a Vermonter, and he was a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist.
Uh-huh.
So he kind of made sure, I had asked him to make sure that the way I was portraying her and the way in which she was going about things was accurate, and he helped me to know that, you know, she really was. So I appreciate you asking me, because that makes me feel like you think I had some real experience. I didn't. No, I haven't done journalistic reporting.
No. Okay. No. Well, yeah, I thought it was fun that she's a reporter and she has so much ambition and she's so, you know, sort of excited about the career she wants to move into, but is being stymied by all of these ridiculous minimal stories. Do you mind if I read a quick sentence here? She sees a couple of people sitting, talking to each other. One of them was a trim young woman with shoulder length, dirty blonde hair. The other was an elderly man. His profile reminded me of Dad. Hopefully the people in the pavilion wouldn't think I was frowning at them as I looked their way. So this is a point early in the book where Polly sees some people and she just finds them interesting and she decides she's going to try to talk to them. And that turns into a story. She finds out what their story is and then she writes it, and we see it in the book. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about developing character. And, you know, the two people that she sees, you know, we sort of get a little snapshot of who they are there, and then we learn a lot more about them. And they kind of discover each other through the course of the story, which is kind of cool. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about developing characters, and also how important to you are physical descriptions, and how do you develop those, which I think is a little bit different than who the people are, but also what do they look like and how much do we have to say about what they look like? Because different people have different ideas about that.
Absolutely. I love that question. And being in New York is a great place to answer that. I do a lot of thinking about the character's backstory. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I will actually write pages of the backstory, which never show up in the novel or the play, other than to inform me of how a character might respond to something. And even though I may have developed the backstory and think the obvious choice is one way that mm-hmm. they would respond, often they don't respond that way because that's who we all are. We're unpredictable. I mean, I like to think that you can really know someone really well, but I've realized throughout quite a few experiences, it's really hard to get to know the real person, someone. So the same thing in with real people, with characters. So even though I think I know a character, so what I do, and the reason I brought up New York, another wonderful writer mentors I had down here, a playwright mentor, Winter Miller, she had suggested that when we're on the subway, we observe people. And the fact that people are on their cell phones now is kind of an odd thing. I mean, you go on the subway and everyone's looking down at their cell phone. But every once in a while, you can catch the way they're holding themselves or the way that they, like, you know, interact with somebody, or they move over, they don't move over, or they look up. And it's all the nuance. It's mm-hmm. all of the little tiny details. And I tend to hold those. I jot things down too, but I kind of keep them in my mind. So when I'm developing a character, I am actually a writer that is not that interested in the physical description. And I've had to add a little bit more than my tendency. My tendency is not really to describe people. Mm-hmm. But I have been, you know, I have just a few trusted people that I get review from, or my editors. That's the one comment I've probably been asked to do more than I tend to do. So I'm really not one that, because mm-hmm. And this is why, Shayla, my reasoning is I like the reader, and it's because I'm a reader too. Sometimes it's great to know, and then you just picture somebody. But when you picture them, it almost leaves little room for imagination. Mm-hmm. I'd liken it to when music videos used to come out, I didn't like them. And I didn't like them because someone else was giving me a visual that went with the song, and I had my own, you know, kind of creative fantasy of what the song was like. So I think because of that, I give respect to my readers, and I want to give them room to imagine. So the description you read is probably, I don't know if you've noticed, but it's probably the most descriptive. I really didn't. Maybe I'll say someone's eye color, but I don't, or I might give their demeanor, you know, their shoulders are slumped, but that's more to talk about their mood and their emotions,
sure,
rather than their physical attributes. So
Yeah, interesting.
It is.
That's great. I wonder, Joy, if this would be maybe a good time for you to read from 37 a little bit, and then maybe we can talk more and then keep going from there.
Okay, great. Thank you. It's a very, you know, I've been doing some book events, and it's actually a really challenging book for me to pick selections, because we have, as I said, the thread of the novel, which is written in one voice. It's a contemporary, you know, woman's perspective and point of view. And then all of the nine short stories are written more like literary fiction. And the woman, it's very meta, you know, Polly is writing the book. So it's not me writing the short stories, it's Polly writing the short stories. So they're written, and they're all so different. So I think for this particular one, I'm just going to read a short section. At some point, Polly, in her frustration and her journey, her only daughter has moved to Spain. She's living abroad. And she invites her mom to come, and Polly's like, okay, fine, I should just go there, because I don't, you know, she's just frustrated. Her mother has died. Her father has Alzheimer's. There's some secret in the family. Her brother, who was her best friend and her confidant, has cut her off. He cut her off right at the mother's funeral. So in this just frustration and trying to understand what is going on in her life, she decides to go to Spain. So I'm just going to read the moment she arrives in Spain at her daughter Nebbie's. And okay.
Okay, great.
Thank you. We hugged for a long, lovely time, then took the metro to Atocha station. The intricate scaffolding of glass and wrought iron was mesmerizing. You could tell Gustave Eiffel had been one of the original architects. Travelers bustled by, but we strolled through the tropical gardens, Nebbie pointing to her favorite spots in the light-filled arboretum. The terminal felt airy and uplifting. It was hard to wrap my head around the fact that just a few years ago, this same place had been ravaged by suicide bombers. A stark, minimalist memorial held constant vigil. We looked up at the hollow cylinder rising 40 feet high from a sea of blue light, and saw that it was filled with words in all different tongues. And those words formed expressions of grief, thousands of messages of condolences and prayers soaring up to the skies. One at the very top read, "It takes a lot of imagination to deal with reality." It took about 15 minutes to walk to Nebbie's apartment, a fifth floor walk up in the Lavapiés neighborhood. Nebbie translated that Lavapiés means wash feet. Her landlord had told her it was probably a reference to the Jewish ritual washing of feet. For our ancestors traveling around the dusty desert in sandals, the washing of feet was a necessity of hygiene and comfort, and more. It was a sign of welcome, and it also had spiritual significance. Abraham offered water to wash the feet of angels. The Kohens, the priestly class, were to wash their feet prior to coming to the altar, a symbol of purity to cleanse the soul. It was a status symbol. Servants washed the feet of their masters, until the most famous Jew came along and had the chutzpah to say that everyone should wash each other's feet, a lesson in humility. Of course, Nebbie had ended up living in Madrid's old Jewish quarter, even though she was one of just a few Jews who now lived there. It had been a long time since Spanish Jews had enjoyed the good life under Muslim Moorish rule. After Catholic monarchs Ferdinand and Isabella married, Mierda hit the fan. In 1492, they ordered the expulsion of all Muslims and Jews. Those who stayed could either convert or be put to death without trial. The edict wasn't formally revoked until 1968. By the time we arrived at Nebbie's front door, I had traveled by car, plane, train, and foot. I was beat. I plopped down my suitcase and makeshift seat. As I stopped to catch my breath before trudging up five flights, Nebbie ran into the store across the alley. It was one of many Muslim-owned shops that now typified Lavapiés. Though very few Jews had come back, it was apparent that a large population of Muslims had returned. Some shops sold Turkish carpets or Tunisian apparel, others candy-colored beads and woven scarves blowing in the breeze like gentle rainbows. Conversations in Arabic mingled with Moroccan melodies. My stomach grumbled, excited by the smells of couscous and spicy fusions. I was so thirsty for new flavors, for new cultures, and for something to drink. Nebbi returned with a water bottle, which I was about to grab when she kneeled down and gently removed my flip-flops. I had no idea what she was doing, but I was too bush to protest. She looked up at me, those big hazel eyes sparkling, her smile soft. She unscrewed the bottle and poured the cool feet on, and poured the cool water on my feet. Welcome, Mom. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for reading that. That's great.
Thanks.
That's a nice section. I like their relationship. All right, wonderful. So I'm going to skip ahead to another question I have, because the part that you read reminds me that a lot of the stories that she ends up involved with and writing about are, they involve travel. And it's kind of a travelogue, as you say in your book's cover. And that makes me think of road novels, and how much we love trips. Right. And reading about people's journeys. So do you have anything to say about why people enjoy reading about journeys?
Oh, such a good question. I think, let me think for a moment. I'm going to just take it from my own.
Sure.
We lead lives. I would hope most people are somewhat satisfied with their lives. But as you know, often we do, like the character Polly, you just kind of fall into things. You fall into a marriage, you fall into a family, you fall into a job. There's not often a great intention in what we do, especially when we're younger. And it's a beautiful thing too, because life is unpredictable and things happen, and if you go with the flow, often you end up with wonderful experiences. But at some point, for many people, that becomes your life. And if it's not fully satisfying, if you are, living in a family or a routine, a marriage, it may be satisfying, but there's a longing for adventure and a longing for, it's kind of what I said about her. She was thirsty for new cultures. And it's actually one of the reasons I absolutely love Vermont. I've been living in Vermont since 1978. I love it. I also really love New York. And I come to New York to get my fix of a diverse population of, we're kind of in a bubble in Vermont. It seems fairly idyllic. I live on a dead end dirt road. It's like the Vermont dream. But I, even though I love it, I miss the reality of what's out there and all the realm of possibility. You picked out that little passage about the sentence about the two people sitting on the bench, and that's what I love about traveling for me, is when you just sit next to a random person and you strike up a conversation. I have had, the day I got off the plane to get here, I was waiting for my daughter to pick me up at the airport, and a woman next to me and I had one of those kinds of conversations that are just so intimate, and so we were laughing, we were sharing things that you wouldn't necessarily share with somebody until you got to know them over time. And then she left and I left. And it happened a couple of days later with someone else. Yeah. And I think that when you're in your own routine, your own group of friends, your own, your route that you take, you, as beautiful as that can be, you miss out on this unpredictability and just the world. It's the world of possibility. So I think perhaps people just want that. It's not even an escape. You just want to know what else is out there. We're existential beings. We have a time that we're going to expire. There's an expiration date.
Right.
And we all know that. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about that, because that would be really hard to handle. But within that, it's kind of like, what do you want to do with your life? I hope people are doing that. I hope we're like going, I have a limited time on this planet. What good can I do for others? Where can I explore? Who can I meet? And so I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that might be it.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a question that has a single answer, but that's a lot of great insights about it. So that's fun. All right. You already talked a lot a little about this when you were talking about how you came up with the idea for the book, but I want to talk a little bit about 1937. I was blown away by how many interesting things happened in 1937, many of which I had heard of but hadn't ever put a date on. You know, the Civilian Conservation Corps is still doing work at that time, and one of your stories concerns that. The Lindbergh kidnapping happened very tragically. The Spanish Civil War is going on. The Hobbit is written. Yeah. And there's more and more and more. And I wondered if you started noticing 1937 everywhere ever since you wrote this. Like, I think the things that we're interested in sometimes seem to follow us. You know, once we have a new focus or obsession, we see it everywhere, right? So are you still seeing 37 everywhere?
Oh my God. As I was going up the One World Trade Center, I took a picture of the 37 in the elevator. I see 37 because it's not the book, as you know, it's about the year, but it also is about that kind of the number, because I do get into kind of, you know, things about the actual number. But yes, and so have other people, because people keep sending me things. When was it? It was right around the book launch. I put the weather on, and it was 37 degrees, and I think there were like three 37s in a row.
Wow.
So I keep doing that. But I do think it is that, I talk about it in the book, I actually don't remember what the word is called, but it's that mindset of, you know, when you, I think I talked about the parents, you know, like you want to get your kids a little, a onesie that has blue 4Runners on it, you know, Toyota 4Runners, and all of a sudden you see them everywhere.
We do
tend to do it, but the number, oh my gosh, it shows up everywhere. Yeah. And the year, it does. You know, someone went for a hike and they sent me a picture. They're like, oh my gosh, look at this old foundation was from 1937. I'm like, yep,
that's it. You must look at the clock and see 37 all the time.
All the time. It's really something.
That's funny. Let's see. I loved, this is just a moment in the book that I will just share. There's this character named Emma, and she's had a rough life in her youth, and she's somebody who's been in and out of foster care, and she gets in some trouble and ends up in court, and a judge gives her two choices. One choice is to spend a year in a juvie facility and then be on probation. But then the second choice is to attend 8 weeks in the Vermont Youth Conservation Corps. And I just loved that judge so much, you know, giving her the opportunity to do something cool and learn something and meet people. And I think that's such a wonderful way to help people move forward when they've had a difficult life. Did you just invent that, or is that something that you had heard of happening, or how did you come to that particular plot point, I guess?
I do remember, it was years ago, again, you know, these things just kind of hang in you. When you're a creative person, there's just like a bank of things that you write.
Right.
And I remembered hearing, it was an NPR story, and a judge asked, it was a person talking about his own experience, and the judge asked him why, which I have in the book, why he was doing what he was doing. And so I just got that, and I thought, what kind of person is that? Like, what kind of man would be in that position and offer that to another? So it was, that was the germ, and then I went from there.
I loved that.
Created, whoops, did I just lose you?
No, are you there?
Oh, okay, yeah, no, I'm here, yeah.
No, I loved that part of the story. I thought that was fun. Now, you know, let's just talk about an enormous number of things that you had to know a little something about to pull them off in this book. So, like, for example, foster care and the judicial system and the CCC and, you know, the Dominican Republic, which we now know that you went to. But talk a little bit about doing the research for this book.
Yeah, I love to research. And it's really kind of funny because as a kid, I always really loved school, but I didn't love my history classes because just the way they were taught back when I was in high school was not very interesting. I ended up, you know, really finding that when I did my own research on history, it was fascinating because and kind of what the character does when you turn the, you tell stories. Mm-hmm. You know, telling stories is very different than facts and figures. So right. when you can get all the sensory details about what people are going through in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, you know. So what I did, I actually used a variety of things. I'll start with the Lower East Side of Manhattan. I came down here and I spent a lot of time walking around the Lower East Side, mm-hmm. kind of just imagining what it was like back then. I went to the Tenement Museum, which is an incredible thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was able to actually see what the plates looked like on the kitchen table, you know. So I did, that's the research I did for that. The CCC, I actually went to the, it was a reunion of the old CCC men with the Youth Conservation Corps. So that was kind of in the book, but I actually did that. And I love interviewing people. I find that's the, to me, you can hear the way someone just speaks about something and you can get the emotion behind it. So I did a lot of interviews. So throughout that, the story about the Italian families, I have my closest friend is her I interviewed her mom, mm-hmm. Mary Turallo, and my ex-mother-in-law was Rita Scarpa Dillon. I interviewed her to get their feeling of what it was like to grow up in an immigrant Italian family. So I did a lot of interviews. I can't remember the other one you mentioned, but...
Right.
But we talked about the Dominican Republic. But I also do a lot of reading. You know, I love special collections at UVM. Uh-huh. I don't know if you've ever been down there. It's incredible. So I love reading and getting, you know, for the CCC, I've got books about the New Deal and the CCC. I get old magazines. Like I ordered an old Life magazine from 1937.
Those
so I
are
could
fun.
Kind of see what was going on, what they were advertising,
right,
and
sure.
those things showed up, and it was the short story that takes place in San Francisco about the woman and the whale.
Yeah.
And I remember finding a face cream that would have been popular then, and I had her, you know, that was her favorite face cream. So there are lots of different ways that I kind of approach it, but I would have to say that to me the real kind of juicy stuff is when I can speak with an actual person and interview them and learn about their experience, whether it is being a journalist or being a seamstress or, you know, there was the story that takes place in Palestine, because mm-hmm. 1938, it was Palestine. And I have very close friends that had come here. I used to host families through the Vermont Refugee Resettlement Program, mm-hmm. and a close family friends that are from Iraq. And they gave me, you know, a lot of those details about the foods and the smells and the, you know, ritual and
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
I love that you don't just, I mean, it's funny because I feel like our world has gotten so opened up by the internet and the ability to just go on Google and look for something and know it in 2 seconds. It's also shut things down though too, right? I mean, it's just a little too easy. I think sitting at your computer, it doesn't show you the world the way going out and like talking to people or, you know, going to an actual building filled with books that you can look at and read things
Absolutely.
And see pictures. So, I mean, it's a little different.
The last play I was commissioned to write was about, I don't know if you or your audience knows about the lost mural, the lost shul mural. It's in Burlington. It's an incredible story. And I was commissioned to write a play about it. And
oh, wow.
I also did that. I spent a lot of time just walking around the old North End. And I knew which buildings, you know, certain people had lived in. And I just, you know, I do a lot of what if, like, what if, you know, this person was walking from here to there. What would their experience? Who would they run into? What would be happening? And yeah, I like to be like in a physical surrounding, but I do Google. I mean, I'm not saying
sure. I mean, we all do Google, but you know, it's funny. Like, I feel like the story you just told, I'd get shivers. Like, if I were like putting things together about houses and figuring out who walked where, and you know, it's like you don't get shivers on Google.
Right. That's a great point. Yes.
Let's see. I want to talk a little bit about transitions. I keep coming back to Emma, which is one of the earlier stories in the book. But anyway, you have this moment where Emma is working for the CCC or the Vermont Conservation Corps, and she comes across a crudely carved set of names, you know, a little graffiti, and it says the Tippy, the prof, and Mac were here, October 1937. And then we kind of jump into a new story with new people, and those are the people that we're going to learn about. And it's this wonderful transition, and we don't completely understand how Emma learns about them until later. But it's really fun. So I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about how you built these transitions to kind of bridge us from one moment to another in the book.
Oh, you can tell you're a writer. Because these are very different questions that I've been getting.
Oh, okay.
I had to transition from the short stories back to the thread of the novel.
Right.
So I did do a lot of thinking about how that was going to happen. And if you notice, you know, so Polly comes across a story and she is either interviewing someone or has heard a story, and then she writes the story and then we read the short story, but then we go back to her life.
Right.
So I had to find, I did spend a lot of time figuring out how we could then go back into her life, how she could learn something from the story and then move forward. I don't know exactly how I did it that you're asking me. I just know that I had to spend time doing it. But as you know, so much of this stuff, the book and the characters and the plot and the trajectory, they just create themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, people say that and you think, well, that can't happen. But when you get in that creative, in the flow, you know, the actual flow and that zone,
yeah,
things just come across. Now, I might spend a lot of time thinking about what the right word is and what the right, you know, just the feeling I want to get, but what's actually happening. I tend to do work this way. I have 3x5 cards. Uh-huh. So I put the cards out and I'm plotting out just generally how I think it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual, once it starts writing, it takes on a life of its own. And then the transitions. Now, I might look back at everything and say, okay, well, in this story, after she learns about the Spanish Civil War and Guernica and moves on to, you know, going back to visit with her daughter, what am I missing here? And so I will take a look at, you know, the 3x5 cards can only go so far, and intuition and flow can only go so far. Then I have to go back in and I have to say, well, you know, this isn't working because in this transition, she is concerned with her relationship with her brother, but we never talked about that earlier before it happened. So I have to make sure that things make sense.
Right.
So yeah, these are such great questions. I'm going to be thinking about these tonight. I'm like, how do I do that?
Do you think your transitions take place in the first draft, or do you tend to find that you're making things fit together better as you revise?
I would say for this, there was a lot of after the fact. And part of that is because some of the stories were written, like the Dominican Republic story, was written before the novel was written.
Okay.
And there were a few others as well that maybe weren't complete drafts, but they were ideas I had. So it wasn't that I had to force fit it, but I had to make sure they made sense. And I didn't use some things that didn't make sense. They had to, you know, actually work to move the story forward, to help the Polly deal with her kind of internal and external conflicts. And if it didn't, I didn't work. So there were some things that I had to kind of figure out, how is this actually going to work?
Right.
But yeah, I would say it was a combination.
Okay. All right. Great. I do always like to ask my guests what they've read lately that they might recommend to listeners. Do you have any book suggestions, things that you've read lately?
I'm in more play mode right now.
So
I'm just looking for, the book. Excuse me, hold one second. I'm just going to grab the book.
Oh, okay.
I highly recommend this book. It's called The Power of the Playwright's Vision. So it's not a novel.
Okay.
But it's actually incredible for any writer. You don't have to be a playwright.
Okay.
It's Blueprints for the Working Writer is the subtitle. So that's where I've been right now. I have to say, I've been listening to audiobooks when I travel. That's
what I
like to do.
I do that a lot, too.
Yeah. And, oh my gosh, I'm on the spot now. I can't even remember the last audiobook that I listened to. And I've been listening to podcasts.
Yeah.
So I've been kind of fixated with the Theranos blood And
oh, yeah, yeah, because she's her trial is going on right now.
Right. So, and I really apologize. I can't even think of the most recent thing I read. I have been reading, but...
It's very funny, Joy. This is the hardest question for everyone, and I can't quite understand why, but I mean, I think because my guests are all readers, of course... They probably all read so much that then all of a sudden that everybody has trouble with this question. It's so funny.
Oh my God. Well, thank you for the generously saying that.
No, it's true.
A little bit like, oh my gosh.
No, it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. Now, what about your writing? What are you working on next? Do you know?
Well, I'm working on this play right now.
That's right. You said. That's right.
Yes, I am. There is a novel in the works. It's actually youth fiction, and it's about... Again, I was a teacher in Burlington for many years, so I had wonderful students that were, you know, we had 44 languages spoken in the Burlington schools, so it's so that rich refugee resettlement program. So,
right.
And my son was a soccer player in the Burlington High School team, and I just met both my students and his friends. I met so many wonderful kids, and so I'm writing a book about a soccer team in Vermont that's composed of people that have come from so many different, you know, very challenging, you know, war-torn zones and things like that, and how they come together and create this beautifully, which is kind of ironic because I started it way before Ted Lasso, and now Ted Lasso is like a big thing. but yeah, that's something I love this book and I love the characters in it. So I'm hoping to finish that probably in the next year.
Oh, yeah. That's great. A few minutes ago, you mentioned Guernica, and I wanted to just, and that reminded me of your publisher, and I just wanted to ask you if you can talk for a minute about your publishing journey, how you got 37 into print.
Yes. That took me almost as long as writing the book.
Did it?
Oh, yeah, it did. I mean, I don't know what your experience has been, but I did start off, well, I see, the problem is I started off wanting to write screenplays.
Right.
And being very naive that I was going to magically get my screenplay produced. And then I realized, oh, you have to get a literary agent, but it has to be a literary agent that focuses on screenplays.
Right.
And, you know, 50 rejection letters later, I just kind of changed. And I'm like, you know what, I'm going to write prose because I really want to write prose. And then I tried to get a literary agent for that. And that was hard too. So I decided, and you really only need a literary agent for the larger, you know, the big six publishing houses.
Right.
You know. But I also started to really think about myself and what my kind of values are. And I love the indie music scene. And I like, you know, I really love to support independent bookstores. And I started to think, well, why not go with an independent publisher? That just seems so much more like who I am. So I started to put it out there to independent. And I actually had three different ones that were very, you know, good possibilities. I sent this, my book to Guernica because it's 1937 and their whole thing is no borders, no limits. And they're all about, I encourage everyone to look at their catalog, their online catalog. They have, the authors are amazing and the books are just so diverse. And I really like that. And I thought it was, and they also have a wonderful presence in, you know, the UK, Canada, United States. I mean, right when the book came out, well, right before the book came out, I did Google to see where it was. And I mean, it's on websites in like New Zealand and Japan. I mean, not that people are buying tons of it there, but they had a much more global presence, which is also so much in line with what the book is about.
Sure.
And so, you know, we went back and forth and I decided that they were just the right people. I had a good feel. I was working with another publisher she was a wonderful person, but I just didn't, it just wasn't the right fit. I just had to go with my gut and mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very happy I landed with them. They're a terrific publishing.
That's
great. They're small. You know, I don't, and it's part of the, you know, you don't get even new authors in big publishing companies, you know, and it's kind of rare to have them do what people used to do, like send you on a book tour. You know, that just happens very rarely these days. Well, especially with COVID. But so my publisher has wonderful publicists. They've been helping, you know, a great deal. a lot of it's up to me, because that's just how the world is. And that's fine, because I enjoy that. I enjoy meeting new people and talking about, like, you know, this is such a pleasure to talk to you about writing and the writing process. And
well, that's great. Yeah.
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 But I would say to anyone out there, just persistence. You have to keep going. Don't ever give up, because, you know, that 51st letter might be the one that does it. And you will find the right thing. You just have to keep going.
That's
and
great.
And self-publishing is an option as well.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Now, I always, and if you don't have one, that's fine. I will come up with something. But I always do offer my listeners who are writers a writing prompt or an exercise or an activity that can help them get a jump start in their work in the coming week. Do you use writing prompts, and do you have any that you might offer?
I do, and I actually teach, and I do this without charging anyone, because I love interacting with people. I actually have a workshop called Writing from the Heart, and I love to get prompts and give prompts. I find it such a great way to, like, jumpstart you and
yes.
get you out of your rut of how you think writing should be. So here's one I like.
Okay.
I would say make a list of 10 characters. They can be actual people in your life. So, you know, mom, the mail carrier, you know, people you maybe know really well or don't know well, or they could be fictional characters
right.
from a movie or from a book. So just make a list of 10. Then make another list of 10 activities. And they can be activities like going for a bike ride, or it can be activities like attending a funeral, you know, so kind of mix it up.
Right.
Something that's different activities, and put the papers away. And then maybe a few days later, come and just say, before you get to the paper, just say, maybe randomly pick out number 3 and number 7. How's that? 3, 7. and so you'll take the character number 3 and put them in that situation number 7
okay.
and then write about that.
Oh, I love that. That's really fun.
It works really well.
Oh,
I mean,
that's a great
the things
one.
That you come up with, yeah.
Okay.
So good luck. I hope that works for
yeah,
people.
That's fantastic. Thank you. That's wonderful. Okay, so I want to mention again that I'm talking to Joy Cohn, and that the book that we are talking about, that we have been talking about, is her debut novel, 37, published by Guernica Editions. And Joy, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you today, and I want to thank you so much for being on Write the Book.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much, Shayla. This has really been wonderful. I would want to put it out to people that even though the book sounds like it's maybe, you know, kind of light and, you know, a woman's travelogue, self-discovery, there's really a lot in there that's about the way people have been oppressed throughout
yeah.
history and across cultures, and the way people have resilience. So it's kind of a combination, and I don't want that point to be missed, because I think it's really important. It's a really important part of what I was trying to do, is just to show our common, you know, the human condition, and how we all at different points in history and in wherever we live, we really share so much of what we go through. And so thank you for this opportunity. It's
yeah.
been so much fun to talk to you, Shayla.
From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've just listened to an interview with local author Joy Cohn, whose debut novel is 37, the number 37, not spelled out, and that's published by Guernica Editions. You can learn more about Joy's work at joylisacohen, that's COHEN.com. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors, or if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, lots of other podcast sites. You can listen to the show. I lost my place. Oh, here we go. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it, and like it on social media and talk about it and tell your friends. Okay, so I'm going to play the theme song from the show, and then I'm going to probably have time to play one more song from 1937. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.